My name is Lindsay, and I am an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlanta Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Wilbur and Harry, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that you will learn what you learn here will be helpful to you in your recovery and or understanding. Baba Tunde will read the preamble.
My name is Baba Tunde. I am an alcoholic. Alcoholic Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contribution. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorse nor oppose any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thank you.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Jessica will read the steps.
My name is Jessica. I'm an alcoholic. 12 steps. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact natures of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for his knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Ryan will read the traditions.
The traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name towards any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, or prestige direct us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never to be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn in public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles over personalities.
The format of tonight's meeting is one 10-minute speaker, our information break, and the main speaker who will speak for 25 minutes, followed by the anniversary celebrants. Our first 10-minute speaker is David.
Thanks. Hi, my name is David, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Ron B. for this opportunity to speak to the Atlanta Group tonight. This is quite a privilege. I didn't always have a problem with alcohol. When I was young, there was no history or problems in my household. I grew up in Connecticut, very nice upbringing. I ended up going to school and studying geology in my undergraduate work. And after I graduated, I turned out I had to go to Houston, Texas, because that's where people end up in geology. And I moved into a nice apartment complex, and there was a lot of fun people. And there was a lot of people named Dave. And so they had to keep track of everyone, so they gave us nicknames. Thanks. So they gave us all nicknames. There was Animal Dave. There was Dave Richter. There was a gentleman named Dave who was always drunk. And so his name was Drunk Dave. And I didn't drink at all at that time. So I'm 23, 24 years old, just because I couldn't afford it. And so I was called Sober Dave. yeah, things were going to change. That was my name, was Sober. Anyway, I ended up leaving Texas and coming back to the Northeast and back to school and was doing some graduate work in physics, and that's when I made a really bad mistake and ended up falling in love with someone. And I was had finished my master's degree and starting on my postdoc, and my girlfriend was really tired of me being poor. And I had a roommate who had just started a business, a PC business. They had just come out at that time. And he talked me into joining him in the business. And so I joined with him. And for 2.5 years, we had that business. And we never really made any money. And as things turned out, he ended up having a nervous breakdown and just skipped town. And I inherited all the business debts. And it was at this time that this great love of my life decided to leave me for a rather wealthy guy. And so at 27, I had to move back home with my parents. Very difficult thing for me. And I couldn't go back into that boyhood twin bed at night without skipping out and having a few kamikazes on the rocks. And that's when I first started using alcohol for its medicinal value, if you will. It turns out things worked out okay, and I ended up moving into here into New York City and was employed for a rather well-known investment bank downtown at the World Trade Center. So I was doing okay, and I ended up moving in with an actress slash dancer slash songwriter on the Upper West Side. It was 104th Street between West End and Riverside, and she was a great gal, but, you know, thespians being what they are, they tend to be a close-knit group and on tour a lot in Summer Stock Theater. And so it turns out that there, you know, she had come back one night and it turned out there had been some infidelities. And things just got very, very crazy after that. I would be finishing work and I would be making my way home up the fourth floor and put my key into the key lock and I would hear a voice saying, "We're not done yet." So I'd have to go back out onto the stoop, and that's when I started hitting the bars pretty hard. And it would come time at work when, you know, I just couldn't go home. And I would zigzag my way up Broadway and have three or four here and three or four there at this restaurant, at this bar, because I didn't want to have 20 at one place, you know, because... I was embarrassed. And what I remember about that time was that I had a seemingly infinite capacity to suffer, you know, and alcohol seemed to really help me get through that situation. So, you know, as I look out at people around here, I'm wondering, you know, who among you might be going through that. But anyway, I was able to get out of that situation, you know, came to my senses. And, you know, this program teaches you that the situation you find yourself in is really your own responsibility. And, you know, should you find yourself on the road to perdition, you really have no one to blame but yourself. But it's been my experience, you know, that there's always plenty of women to help you along the way. And so there was one more. And this was a great gal. She was a waitress and exquisite beauty. She was half Trinidadian and half Polish, if you can imagine that. I mean, just exquisite. And she moved in with me, and she came home one night. She used to work late. And she came home, she sat on the couch, and she said to me, I think I'd like to try women. And, you know, it didn't occur to me that this would be a problem. Not that I was thinking of anything otherwise, but turns out the next night she went out with someone and just never came back, you know. And that's when I really started to hit the bottle pretty hard. And but look, the truth of the matter is I had come to some sort of an arrangement with my life and alcohol, you know. I would go to work. Turns out I was actually thriving at work. I ended up, you know, becoming a director at the investment bank. And instead of, you know, after work, I would go out and I would just drink. And I would drink really hard. And never occurred to me that I was a functioning drunk, was what I was, you know. And things seemed to be okay, and I had an arrangement with life. But then the first plane hit the first tower, the North Tower at the World Trade Center. And that's when I really became unhinged. I really, you know, in 10 minutes you can't go into exactly what all that entails. But it turns out at that point, and this is months afterwards, after recovery and whatnot, when I got home, I was afraid. And it wasn't so much that I was afraid to go to sleep. It was I was afraid of what might happen to me as I slept, you know. And so I would drink until I could hardly stand up and then throw myself into bed. And then one night I came home from work. This is February 03, and I had a particularly bad day, and I had a magnum of Jack Daniels. And turns out the building had turned the boiler off. And I went into the kitchen area and turned on the gas stoves and passed out. And woke up at the burn unit of New York Presbyterian Hospital. Had no idea what had happened. And that's a pretty scary feeling in that I had no idea what other harm I'd cause other people. And one thing, if you know, if you ever end up in a burn unit, there are no mirrors. Turns out that I was okay. It wasn't a major catastrophe. I had there in there for observation, mostly for smoke inhalation. I was so passed out, I hardly breathed at all. So it turns out I didn't have much of a problem. But I had to contact a lawyer, you know, in order to help myself out with this situation. And it was very difficult, and I continued to drink. And I had to move out of the building. Had renovations, moved back in, and many months later, I wound up at St. Luke's Hospital for some kind of psychiatric observation. And turns out that I had been roaming the halls in the building and broke a window on the 11th floor and threw a bicycle out the window. And the superintendent found me in the stairway having a deep conversation with a potted plastic plant. That was enough for me. I stopped at that point, got some help, and obviously I had to contact my lawyer, you know, and inform him of the situation. And I'd actually left him a voicemail, you know, saying, look, this is what happened. And he gave me a call the next day, and he said, we'd like you to come in. We want to have a chat with you. And I was like, oh. I don't know what the legal ramifications of this are. Who knows what's going to happen? And I came in, and he has my folder out, and he's like, a fire in February 3, and you got this, and employment, and you threw a bicycle out a window, and would you like to come with me to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting? I had never known such kindness. This was not a business relationship. I was just you could have knocked me over with a feather. And I've been coming back ever since, and I can tell you that these days I have no problem sleeping. I come back every week, and I'm thinking of the people who are out there who may be having some problems, maybe perhaps like mine, maybe perhaps a little bit different. But you don't have to drink tonight. And if you found yourself here, please come back. Thank you very much.
Speaker tapes may be borrowed from the lending library. As we said, this is open to anyone. This meeting is open to anyone. However, we are an anonymous fellowship and ask that what you hear and whom you see remain here. If you are speaking at another group and wish for some of us to come for support, please write the information on the sheet on the bulletin board. And our main speaker tonight is Cookie.
Hi, my name is Cookie. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is Potpourri, which meets in New York on 16th Street between 2nd and 3rd every night at 6. And you're all welcome because they told me when I walked through the doors that I was welcome. I brought up a grapevine because the cover has my sponsee on it. We've been friends, and I've sponsored her for a long time. She now has 18 years. So for all the young people, this is a possibility. I always, when I start talking, I'm nervous. And I start to think of myself as a channel because that gets rid of the ego stuff. And I ask my higher power to just help me carry the message, and whatever I say hopefully will help somebody. It certainly will help me because I will remember. I had my 22nd anniversary on August 6th of this year. So and I celebrated it at a conference in Canada because I get asked to speak occasionally, like tonight. But my home group does have its anniversary on Friday night, and hopefully I'll be able to celebrate there. I started out as not the child of alcoholics, but as the child of foreigners. Myself being foreign, I learned English in this country. I was always the odd man out in school. I always felt different. I didn't know how to play your games. I didn't know what to eat. I didn't know how to look like you. And I really wanted to belong, but I didn't know how because my family was different. And so I, early on, like the age of 5 and 6, I pretended that I didn't care if you didn't invite me to your birthday party. I was the last person picked on any team because I didn't know how to play. And I pretended that was okay. And I made up this whole world that I created in books and music. And I was a child of the 60s, so I ran off to San Francisco. And I wore flowers in my hair. And I met a rock and roller, and I got married. And we played for free, and we had, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And I lived communally, and I threw up a lot. My first drink was Southern Comfort. It's dreadful, but it gets you very drunk. My second drink was Peppermint Schnapps with a bunch of bikers. It's also dreadful, but it gets you very drunk. And I never drank for the taste. I always drank for the effect. And somehow I discovered that I was shy. I wasn't like everybody. I didn't belong to anything. But in this small group of rebels who were out on the West Coast, when I felt that click and that burn from the alcohol, it didn't matter how I felt anymore. I felt I was okay. I was It was okay to be me, whatever that me was. And so I was not afraid, and I did all kinds of stupid stuff. And I ended up touring with the rock band. And in those days, the dress du jour was taking a paisley tablecloth, cutting a hole in it, putting lots of beads on and a few feathers, and just appearing, you know. No underwear, of course. And I dance, and I get drunk, and I passed out a lot in equipment boxes, which is almost like being homeless, because they are, you know, in the back. And I never wanted to be out front, and I did this. I traveled all over the United States, but I never knew what hotel room I was going to be in that night. They all look the same when you start going into chain hotels, and like I couldn't tell you whether it was 210 or last night was 312 or tomorrow was going to be 111. And so I'd wander up and down halls at 4 o'clock in the morning and wait for somebody to open a door and say, "You belong in here." And it was kind of fun, though, you know. It was just very disorganized. We got a lot richer, and I started going in limousines. Well, limousines are traveling bars. You don't have to drive. You just have to sit there and sample the white one and the brown one and the other one. And I would start out with all my finery and my feathers and my things. And then all of a sudden, I would get, you know, I'd throw up in the limo, and I'd get to the hotel, and the feathers were matted, and it was dreadful. And they'd sort of clear a path, you know. And I think, well, it was because I was so important. And they'd clear the elevator. I'd get up to my room, and the first thing I'd do is I'd pick up the phone. I'd go, "Room service, a bottle of vodka, please." And they'd go, "How many glasses?" "I don't know. Whatever you think," I'd say to them. Because they thought I was having a party. And I was just ordering my bottle. And so it went on like that all over the planet. And in the meantime, I had two children and a horse ranch in Northern California. So I was quite happy. And one day, my 14-year-old daughter was riding her bicycle. She was hit by a 15-year-old boy who was drunk on beer, and he killed her. And my life stopped, and I felt like my heart had been amputated, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to cope. I didn't know how to deal. And I sat in a chair for 3 months. I sat in a chair at my ranch, and I didn't eat, and I didn't sleep, and I didn't do anything. And my husband got really worried about me, and he called my best friend, and he said, "We have to do something about Cookie." And she said, "Oh, I've got the perfect solution." And she came, and she said, "Hold out your arm," and she gave me a shot of heroin. And I proceeded to be able to function, and I got strung out, and I went in those days, that lasted for like 3.5 years. I got hepatitis, I got staph infection, I got all the terrible things that happen when you use drugs and you don't care. And I went into, in those days in California, they only had mental hospitals that took you in, and they asked me when I checked in, they said, "The nuts are at the top, the alcoholics are in the middle, and the drug addicts are at the bottom. And where are you?" And I said, "I'm at the bottom." And they said, "Well, you can never do drugs again, and we'll cure you." And I said, "Fine." And so they did. And as I was leaving, they said to me, "Now you should go out and drink socially." And I said, "Okay." And so I went out knowing that I would never do another drug, but that I would drink socially. I have never drank socially in my entire life. I haven't a clue how to do that, today included. And my idea of drinking socially was if you had a drink, so shall I. And so I hung out with a lot of people that drank more than me, and I never got it right. I do not have a hollow leg. I tried drinking what you drank. That didn't work. I blamed the ice. I blamed the cherries. I blamed everything but the booze. And I finally decided that I was defective and that I had been brought up with lots of willpower. I left my husband, whom I adored. I moved back to New York. I got a job, and I hoped, and I stopped drinking on my own. Didn't know about AA. And hoped that it would all be over soon. And every day I would think about having a drink, and every day my willpower would say, no, you're not going to do this. And every day I would hope that maybe walking through the streets of New York, a taxi would jump the curb and hit me, or an air conditioner would fall on me, or something would happen beyond my control to end this jail that I had created for myself that was just as miserable. I don't recommend it to anybody. And finally, a friend of mine showed up and made dinner and put a bottle of wine with the dinner. And I said, but I don't drink. And my friend said, but it's a delicious gourmet dinner, and I've cooked it specially. And and the wine goes with it. And after six no's, I said, well, it's only wine. And I had it. And 3 days later, the progression was where it had ended. I didn't know I had a disease. I didn't have a clue I was an alcoholic. And now I started feeling uncomfortable when I didn't have the drink, and I decided I had insomnia, and I had to take a bottle to bed with me because that was the only way I could get to sleep. And so that lasted for about 6 months or so. And then I knew that I couldn't control it anymore. I needed a drink. My skin started to crawl. I started to feel funny, and I didn't know what to do. I had really tried everything on my own to stop, and it hadn't worked. So now I checked myself into one of those 5-day detoxes, and what do they have? AA. And I shuffle in my paper slippers feeling less than, and there's somebody at the door that looks like an old Edgar G. Robinson movie, and he's going, ha, 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 welcome to AA. And I'm going, oh, my God, this is what it's come to. And I sat and listened to a totally different story than mine, but somehow I felt the feelings were perhaps similar to something that I may have felt at some time. I had tried not to feel for a long time. And for those 5 days, I went to a different meeting every night, and I listened, and I got that little seed of hope that we get when we come to AA and we're desperate and there's nothing else. There's nothing else being offered to us. And they told me to go to a meeting when I left and to get a sponsor in a home group. I got the home group. I didn't say anything. I sat in the front because they told me to. I waited for them to say, excuse me, you're taking up room. Please leave now. We have someone else more important. That didn't happen. I didn't know how to get a sponsor. My sponsor, I went up to the chairperson, who I was sure was the chairperson of AA or something, the president perhaps, and they got me my sponsor because there was a lady standing there that said, I'll be your sponsor, dear. And I said, okay, now that's done. And then she said, you'll call me. And I said, what will I call you? And she gave me her name, and she told me to call her at a certain time every day, and I did, and we went to meetings, and then she invited me to her home group by telling me to meet her at her apartment. And I thought, oh, that's what a sponsor's for. I'm supposed to help her get to her meeting. Obviously, she's been going for years, but, you know, she needed me. And I met her sponsor, and I met her sponsor's sponsor, and that was very, very appealing to me. And when I had my 90 days, she said to me, you will find a power other than yourself. I don't really care what you call it, as long as it's not you. And I said, you know, I've lost a child. I don't believe in God. I've given up on my religion. And she said, doesn't matter to me what you've decided. And so I picked the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am not afraid of books. And I figured it kept you all sober all these years. Maybe you could do that for me. And I was told to say please in the morning and thank you at night. And I did that, and I read it. And I asked her questions, and I decided that, you know, I was one of those people it wasn't going to happen for, and she told me my name wasn't written any place in the big book. And so that remained my higher power for a long time, and then she told me I'd make coffee. And I said to her, I've been married, I know how to make coffee, I give parties, I have an espresso machine, not necessary. And she said, you'll make coffee, dear. And I said, no, you don't understand. I really know I can even grind beans. I have all that at home. And she said, you'll make coffee. And I thought she was hard of hearing. I didn't want to lose her. So I made coffee. And I made the coffee. You'd come up and you'd ask me if the coffee was ready. And I'd curse out the coffee pot because I couldn't talk to you. And you know what? People thanked me for making the coffee. And I thought to myself, they're lunatics. I'm screaming at a coffee pot, and they're thanking me for making the coffee. And that's how I learned to get into AA. I got into service. The more you allowed me to do, the more I learned about me. I find that service sprinkles miracle grow in your character defects. I never thought I had them until I started getting resentments. I found out what steps were all about, doing service. And you kept encouraging me every time I wanted to do something. You encouraged me. And I ended up being your area secretary. I've never typed in my life. And I thought you were all kidding. And I didn't know a thing about computers. And so you told me how to enter things in the database, and then I pushed a little button that said delete. Do you want to delete this? And I said, oh, yes. And I lost the whole thing. And I decided I was moving to Tahiti, and now I had to make a 10th step to the entire Sini area, which is southeast New York, and tell them that I had just deleted everything. And there was a young man who said to me, I can bring this back to you, to the database, if you will make me a cup of coffee. See, the coffee sort of floats in and out of the story. I made the coffee, we got the database back, and I remained secretary of Southeast New York, and that was a big learning experience for me. I was elected delegate for this area. What an honor. Me. I looked at all the derelicts on the street going to the hotel, and I said, that should be me, not somebody dressed. Thanks to AA and all of you, this is where I am today. And what committee was I assigned to? My committee was Big Book 4. And I thanked my higher power because it was such an honor for me to get to work on this book that it kept me sober and all of you sober. And I'm so honored to have been part of this. And I have a 9/11 story, too, for Dave, who let us know how very painful it was. I live very near there. I watched the towers go down. I watched people running around in the streets looking for loved ones. I smell that smell that I can still smell in my dreams. I didn't know what to do, but I knew I shouldn't drink. And I went to my home group, and we had an 11-step meeting that night. And found out a few nights later, we got a call from General Service, and I was asked to help start a meeting down there along with some other people. And I went down there because, as I said, gratitude in action to me has always been service. And so I went down there. I got a hard hat, another backstage pass, had to wear special shoes, and could go through this crime scene that was horrific. And we did a meeting for people for 6 months who could not get out. And we manned it 24/7, 6-hour shifts, through some very, very dramatic situations. And I chose to read the daily reflections as when I chaired the meeting down there, so that we could, because I didn't know how to speak to you about the horrors, but I knew a little bit about recovery. And we started this blackboard, and people from all over who were working down there wrote their first name, their last initial, and their home group. And sometimes they'd come in and just call their sponsor, you know, and talk to me about their group at home. And there was one man who counted days down there, and he ran one of those huge cranes. And I was so grateful he wasn't drinking, because that crane could have killed us all. But he counted his days, and he said he couldn't stay sober in the Bronx where he came from, but he was staying sober down there, so we never know what it is that reaches us, you know. But I was so glad to be a part of. And when I chaired the big meeting at Intergroup of several years ago, the two gentlemen who were the iron workers took pieces of the tower and made the AA circle and triangle. They gave one to the General Service Office and one to New York Intergroup. And I was proud to introduce them that day. It really gave my heart a thrill. I have been, as a result of AA, able to travel, and I have been, I really have a fondness for special needs, and I understand how people who have other problems than alcohol, and I have always wanted to see what more we could do for them. And so I have been on Indian reservations, and I have been in remote communities up in the Arctic, and I have helped sober up some people who are blind and deaf. We had a blind man come to our group, and he kept going out. I went up to him one day, and I said, I don't know what to do, because is there something more this group could do for you? And he said, well, it's not you, it's the dog every day goes into the bar, and he's used to it. I got that. So we met him at the bus every day, group of us, and we walked him to the meeting, and you know what? The dog got 90 days. And he's got 18 years of sobriety today. Not the same dog. But it goes to show, you know, I've scribbled on napkins with people who don't hear, you know, and gotten interpreters. We started something here called Sober Over 60, which if all of you don't drink and you don't die, you're going to get to. You know, amazing stuff. And we started thinking about, like, what more can we do for people who need us? And today I'm feeling comfortable with the fact that there's so much to do in AA. And even though I've rotated out of my positions that you've elected me to, I've served other fellowships because you've given me the tools to do that. And I'm happy to be able to say to them that we can be of service to them. And I serve at my home group. I sell the grapevine. And I sponsor people who are as dear to me as they could possibly be. And I want to thank Helen for inviting me tonight, and all of you, and Jimmy for giving up his seat to my sponsee, Megan. And thank you very much for my sobriety.
Good evening, everyone. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Helen, and I chair the Atlanta Group. Let's all thank tonight's speakers, David and Cookie.